Welcome to Galactic Chat. My name's Alex, and joining me is Nikki Soulway, author of numerous short stories and novels, and especially noteworthy at the moment, the novel Repetta, which I promise we'll get to talking about soon. Thank you very much for joining me today, Nikki.
Thank you, Alex. It's lovely to be here, being there.
Somewhere over the waves. So I want to just start by asking you kind of general question about your writing career overall. I'm not a writer of fiction myself, and I'm always fascinated to hear about people's experiences and reasons for writing fiction, especially those people who say they just can't help but write. It's something they've always done. Is that you, or did you come to it differently?
I think that's me some days, but on the other days it's the opposite of me. But on the other days it's probably I would do anything except write, like most people. How did I come to it? I started writing when I was quite young. And I came to it because I was then and still am a deeply passionate and embarrassingly fanatical reader.
I don't think there's anything embarrassing about that.
Oh, no. I remember reading this lovely anecdote. I'm trying to think what it was in, actually, but a fellow who'd written a book about his experiences of being a reader. And he wrote about finding himself at about 10 years old, lying on the floor in the library, drooling on the carpet whilst reading. And I thought, oh, no, that's me.
That kind of sounds like me too. I think that's awesome.
I was that child who my mother said, you know, you come into the house and she said, where have you been? I've been calling for you for hours, and I've been up a tree somewhere reading.
Fantastic.
So really, I guess like a lot of writers, but, you know, I came to writing because I loved reading so much and wanted to I think when I first started, probably just wanted to write the same sort of things that I loved reading.
Yep.
And only later started to be a more critical reader and started looking for gaps in, or not looking for, but sort of became aware of the gaps in the things I was reading and the things that I wanted to read about that weren't there.
Yeah, so I was actually going to ask you about what you're trying to achieve or accomplish through your fiction. So is it filling those gaps these days? Is what helping to drive you?
It's become more that. I don't think that's where I started out. I think when I started out, I really just wanted to write beautiful sentences and emotionally engaging stories. That was my goal, and it shifts all the time. But more and more I've become, I guess, what you'd call a politically engaged writer, but at a very personal level. I've always been a feminist.
Mm-hmm.
Well, always. I'm not sure I came out of my mother and said, right.
Here's how to fix the patriarchy.
Yeah. But I am a committed feminist, an unapologetic feminist, and I'm queer, so that comes with its own set of experiences. And I'm more and more conscious of the ways that those things are underrepresented in fiction and in publishing.
Yep.
And when they are represented in often in problematic ways, and that it's still our job as women and queer people to kind of redress that balance, to work at redressing that balance. So that's my goal now.
Sure, that's
to be part of that project.
It's a big goal, but it's a great one. So if you're particularly inspired originally by what you read, who these days would you credit as being your literary influences then, I guess, either for good or for ill?
Oh, I always hate this question. Tomorrow, I'm
sorry.
I'll have different answers for you. But today, this is my answer today, I always go back to Annie Dillard.
Right.
Who I adore reading. And I'm looking at my bookcase, because I recently moved, it's unpacked in a very higgledy-piggledy way. And all of the children's books are in my office. Oh, who else? I read Jeanette Winterson when I was very impressionable, and she remains very close to my heart.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I think that she's a perfect writer, but none of us are.
Yeah.
And I am always inspired by Anne Carson, the poet and translator. I adore her work.
So it's quite an eclectic mix then.
Yeah, sorry, a bit of a mess.
No, it's not a mess. I think it's probably pretty reflective of a lot of writers.
I think if you want to write seriously, which is what I want to do, then possibly it's important that you read as eclectically and widely as you can.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So over the last few years, you've had a number of publications, both short stories and novels, not all of which have been in speculative fiction, which is, of course, how I've heard about you. I think I read your short story in Shimmer a few years ago, and you've had a short story published in Andromeda Spaceways and, of course, Repetta. But briefly, I had a look at your Goodreads page, as one does, and I saw, and on your website, you took this. I think you've got two other novels that you've had published as Nicole Burke, and from their blurbs, I don't know what the term is these days, mainstream, literary, that sort of area, that genre, if you want to call it that.
Yeah, I guess. That's very hard, isn't it? They're contemporary realist fiction, which
is how I've... That's a great phrase, contemporary realist.
Yeah, because I am uncomfortable with literary as a label, because for all kinds of complicated reasons.
Absolutely.
Because people react to it, I guess.
Yeah, it brings in all sorts of messy politics.
To call themselves literary,
seems a bit pretentious, really.
Yeah.
So what then brought you to speculative fiction with Repetta and with some of your short stories? Has that been something you've always been interested in writing?
Absolutely. So I've always written them. I didn't always get them published.
Sure, yep.
Some of my great loves reading as a young person and still were speculative fiction, and it continues to be a kind of thread in my bookcase.
Yep.
So it's what I read. It's one of the things I read within that area. And what brought me to write Repetta? So I had been writing short stories in that genre for a long time. I have two abandoned novels, or at least two and a half abandoned novels that are broadly speaking speculative fiction, and one that I'm working on at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to Clarion South in 2005. I hope I get that right. Oh, it was a long time ago, 2005. And I wrote a short story there which became part of Repetta, was the kind of first bit of Repetta. It's in the middle somewhere, but it was the thing I wrote. So it's working in that genre is a kind of, has been a continuous part of my process.
Yep.
This novel has been a kind of, I guess it's not huge, but for me it feels huge. So it's been a growing into that.
Fantastic.
Space and getting some readership in that space, which is really exciting.
So, I mean, I have to say up front that I adored Repetta. I thought it was just wonderful.
Oh,
so I'm
you.
By no means unbiased in talking to you now. And rather than me gushing about it and trying to explain it to those crazy people who haven't yet read it, everyone just read Repetta. can you summarise what it's about? Have you got a nice pithy little explanation for annoying people who ask you what your latest novel's about?
No. I'll just be difficult.
Well.
I don't have a pithy one. The very short one is that it's about love.
Mm-hmm.
The much longer one is that it's a story told in two threads. One is the 400-year-long story of an artificial woman, mostly woman, sort of woman. And the other is the story of a history student, Henri or Henriette, who is studying at something largely analogous to a university in the now, but a now that's very different to the now we live in.
Yep.
Mm.
That's pretty pithy. That's good.
Okay. Good.
You said before that this has been a part of your life for a while now. So if you started did you start in Clarion South, or had you already been thinking about these sorts of issues before that?
Well, certainly some of the issues that I write about in the book are issues that I write about almost obsessively in one way or another. But this book really started at Clarion. And, well, it's hard to say that a book started at any one point. There were bits and pieces, and there were kind of abandoned stories that had never quite come off, and things that were almost like this book. So it had a long, like most of my work, that's how I work, has a kind of long and scattered evolution.
Sure.
I started working on the novel seriously after I got home from Clarion.
Okay.
After the Clarion 6 weeks, and so there was the 12-week post-Clarion depression.
So after that point.
After that point.
Right. I've heard people, particularly at conventions, for instance, have semi-serious but sometimes semi-humorous also arguments about whether it's better to be a pantser or a plotter, that is, uh-huh. someone who sets out the plot in advance and knows where it's going, as uh-huh. opposed to those people who fly by the seat of their pants.
Uh-huh.
You sound more like a pantser.
Oh, I'm
so a horrible pantser. Term, but...
It's a term, but I'm glad that I'm wearing pants. I'm a pantser. I have vague ideas of where I'm going. I really, there's this wonderful poem that Robert Lowell wrote about Elizabeth Bishop, or for Elizabeth Bishop, and he talks about this process that she had, where she would pin one word to one side of her pinboard and another word to the other side of the pinboard, and then wait sometimes years to fill in the gap between them. And that's my planning process. Start here and I'm going there, and I don't know how I'll get there, but I will get there eventually.
That sounds inspiring, actually.
Oh.
I'm glad it works.
I'm glad it works too.
I'm really interested by what you said earlier about being increasingly, I guess, inherently political, and I think this novel is certainly a political novel in that sense, that whole the personal is political and so on.
Yeah.
So do you feel like you achieved what you hope to achieve with Rapetta? Maybe?
Some of the things I wanted to achieve, yes. I mean, every book that I write, and I think a lot of writers feel this way, every book that I write, you know, it's never everything. It's mm-hmm. never... You know, that's why you write the next one, right? Because it doesn't do everything. Now, I had this really funny experience at WizCon, actually, where I went to WizCon to accept the Tiptree Award.
Yes.
And it was an amazing experience. I had an amazing time. And was part of some fantastic conversations. I'm deeply introverted, so mostly eavesdropped on a lot of fascinating conversations.
Uh-huh.
But... one of the things that happened to me that while I was there and accepting this award, which was really fantastic, was that I felt very keenly and quite suddenly the deep conservatism of Rapetta.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Like, wow.
Hadn't gone far enough, and that there were things in there now that I wish I had pushed further, and complacencies that I hadn't interrogated and...
I see.
So, but that's when I'll write the next book. That's okay.
Yeah, like, sure.
I think, in a way, it's okay, because those are those questions and those discomforts are what will drive me when I write the next book.
And they're kind of what enabled you to get to WizCon in order to...
I must have needed to hear those conversations. So, yeah.
And I do want to talk about the Tiptree for a moment, but can I just... what was WizCon like? What's it like as a group of people?
They were terrifyingly magnificent. They were intelligent and vibrant and loud.
Wow.
Loud people. They were very friendly and warm and welcoming. And I went with my partner and... mm-hmm. You know, and we did that thing. We went back to our hotel room and talked about what was happening and how we were feeling about it a lot to detox. And we talked about, you know, for us anyway, and you know, this is just our limited experience. Mm. I had never had the privilege of being part of panels about, for example, gender queerness that were that sophisticated and informed, and not just from the panel members but from the audience. So I never had that horrible experience you have at festivals and cons where it's question time.
Yes.
And you just think, I should have sat closer to the exit. And that just never happened at WizCon. Like, some of the conversations that happened on the floor and around were just intense and amazing. And which is not to say that the strange thing was that when I came home and on social media and stuff, I've since seen that some people had a negative experience of being there.
Right.
Which just shocked me.
Yeah.
I thought it was like Luna Park. Mardi Gras rolled into one.
That's possibly the greatest endorsement I've heard for WizCon ever.
plus something intellectual and kind of, deeply stimulating, but this magnificent.
So rather than having those annoying first-year conversations, you've actually moved to post-grad conversations.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know that feeling when you're at a con or a writers' festival and you have a conversation about queerness or women and you feel like you're explaining it to first-year undergraduates?
Absolutely.
And
feminism 101.
Yeah, and saying, it's okay, you know, that sort of, it's okay that we're feminists and it's okay, you know, like reassuring people. And I'm so sick of... It's a necessary conversation, but I'm also tired of it because it's limiting. So it was so exciting and liberating to be in a space where a great deal of thinking was just taken for granted, and a great deal of a body of ideas and a body of work were taken for granted. So it was really stimulating and exciting. And I want to find a way to bring it to Australia or to nurture that space in Australia somehow. I'm still working on that.
Absolutely. And I have to say, it's really awesome to talk to someone who is unashamed is not really the right word, but you said earlier you're a feminist and you've always been a feminist, and that's actually a really refreshing thing to hear someone not saying, oh look, I just have to say I'm a feminist in that sort of embarrassed way that some people do. Do you feel like in Australia or in, I guess, for want of a better word, literary circles, there's still a stigma around the idea and the word of feminism?
I do. I think it's possible that there was a time when there wasn't, and then there's been a reaction. Mm-hmm. I remember reading Faludi's Backlash, like back in the 90s, and thinking, you know, oh yeah. But I think there is, in the literary space in Australia that I'm aware of, there is a backlash, and it's a kind of... it's a backlash that people like the founders of the Stella Literary Prize are very aware of and are trying to have a conversation with and have a productive response to. Mm. But I think it's definitely there. I had this moment today actually where I got cross about how do you remember a few years ago there were those Vita statistics got released about in the US and the UK, the reviewing of fiction particularly.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and it's one of the conversation around that was part of the conversation that led to the founding of the Stellar Awards. So,
yep.
And it's something I've always been interested in, you know, in this kind of observational way, not in a critical way. I certainly haven't done any deep research on it. But whenever I pick up the weekend papers, and there's this automatic part of me that does a count, like a little gender count and a little people of colour count,
yep.
You know, a little queer count, which is, you know, mostly beside, you know, pointless.
Yes.
But that gender count all on its own is very telling and is still problematic and still hasn't been addressed. And so there are still problems, and they're largely at the unconscious and unspoken level, which are the hardest problems to address, I think.
Mm. And I think it was this year and maybe last year, Strange Horizons did a similar count for specifically specfic venues. And for our listeners, if you're interested, I'll make sure there's a link to both the Vita statistics and to the Strange Horizons one as well.
Yeah.
So it's a controversial question, but I'm interested in your perspective. Do you think Rapetta would be better off if it wasn't associated with the term feminism? How do you think the publishing industry and the consuming public feels about a book with that, it's not a label, but that association?
I think it will turn off some. I guess if it had that label on the front cover, it would turn off some readers.
Mm-hmm. Is that a problem, I guess, is the real question.
I'm not a marketing person. I'm off the book. You know, I guess... Yeah. I feel it's a problem in the sense, not for me and not as the author of the book, it's a problem for my publisher if they don't sell the books and for me. But I think if it puts people off reading the book, then the broader problem is why are people so put off by that as a label? And I think part of the problem is that people increasingly misunderstand what feminism is and what its aims are as a movement and all those sorts of things. So people who... My perception is that the large body of people who react against the idea of something being feminist even or, you know, have actually no idea what the movement is about.
Mm. Yeah.
And are reacting to a very kind of monster.
Yes.
Of it. Rather than reality.
Yeah, absolutely. So getting back to what you mentioned earlier, it was really exciting to learn that you had won the James Tiptree Jr. Award, which...
I know!
For those of our listeners who don't know, this is an award which is given each year by a jury which acknowledges speculative fiction works that expand or explore the concept of gender within the genre. And each year the jury is different, and each year the jury defines what they mean by expanding or exploring the concept of gender for themselves, which I think just makes this an amazing award. So congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
I can't imagine what it would have been like to discover that you were the winner, that you were on the shortlist and then that you were the winner.
It was pretty astonishing. I found out both at once, of course. They called me and told me. I was at the movies when they called. I was watching Saving Mr. Banks.
Right.
Which, you know, I don't want to spoil the movie. I was at the movies and then I went outside the movies and there's a movie cinema in one of those big shopping malls, you know. So I was in this massive shopping mall and got a message from Ellen Klages, who's mm-hmm. an astonishing woman, but she's one of her roles is that she was the chair of the judging panel this year and let me know that I won. And I don't know that I can describe, it's like sports people trying to describe the feeling of winning.
Sure.
Or it was pretty amazing. It was pretty amazing.
Very cool. And I was reading a little bit on the Tiptree website, and again, I'll put a link to that, about the award itself, the physical things that you get. And for that also, it sounds like an amazing award.
I got this huge swag of stuff. Like, we got chocolate, which is very important. There was a lot of chocolate. And T-shirts, and there's this beautiful little croissant pin, which has Space Babe on it, who's the icon of the Tiptree. They commissioned an artwork for the person who won, so I have a artwork by Carl Cohn, I hope I'm saying his name correctly, which is, Rapetta has a wind-up heart, and he made a wind-up heart.
That is amazing.
Which is absolutely beautiful. There was cake. I wore a tiara for a week. It's just the most. And they sang me a song.
And I was going to say, didn't they serenade you?
They serenaded me on stage. I cannot tell you what it's like to have the motherboard of the Tiptree serenade you on stage in front of a ballroom full of about 1,000 people who are, like, singing along because the words are projected on a screen.
Wow.
It was. I don't think that anything in my life will ever be quite like, anything else will ever be quite like that.
That sounds just astonishing.
It was really astonishing. And the motherboard are made up of some really amazing people and, it's just words can't describe how. And it was founded by Pat Murphy and Karen Joy Fowler.
Mm.
And it's, you know, they fund it largely through bake sales at WizCon, and they've had a couple of cookbooks, which you must get. They're fantastic.
Excellent.
that, can't remember what they're called. One's something like burning down the house or something.
Was there one, I think, maybe named after a Tiptree short story, The Smoke Grows Up Forever?
That's right. I think The Smoke Grows Up Forever from the Kitchen,
I think. Yeah, something along those lines.
The cookbook is called.
Yeah.
But it's this really wonderful one, and it's named for James Tiptree, of course, who was an alter ego for Alan Sheldon and was outed by Jeff Smith, who's on the motherboard.
That's fantastic. Have you read the biography of Alice Sheldon / James Tiptree?
I have read the Phillips biography.
What's glorious.
Just magnificent. She's a deeply fascinating person. And, yeah, it's a wonderful biography, really wonderful biography. Yeah. And worth reading if you're at all interested in all manner of strange things.
Indeed. She led a remarkable life.
She did. She was a spy for the CIA, and she was a research psychologist, and she had travelled in Africa as a young child.
She was a chicken farmer.
She was a hen farmer.
A hen farmer, sorry. Hen farmer. Yes, indeed.
Honestly, she calls it an egg farm. Egg farmer. She was married to an alcoholic poet who shot her, and then, of course, her life ended in a murder-suicide. She killed her husband and then herself. So she's the most astonishing life, and out of that,
some astonishing fiction.
Some astonishing fiction in the chinks of that world. She managed to produce some amazing work.
So you said just before that words can't describe receiving the award, but of course you did have a very awesome speech gave, which the motherboard have posted on their website, and again I'll put a link to that so that people can read it for themselves. And the motherboard calls it a remarkable speech, and I think that it's also it's a beautiful speech. It's just spectacular. And I just wanted to ask a couple of things about it. That for a start, you talk about the inspiration of Descartes and the opening date and all those sorts of things, which I found deeply fascinating, because I think I'd sort of recognised some of the things that you were talking about, but I hadn't considered them on any real analytical level, that whole mind-body disconnect that Descartes suggests and that you're trying to, and I think do, question and interrogate quite interestingly.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess how did you come across Descartes, and were you inspired right at the start to interrogate that, or is that something that you've been thinking about over however many years?
I first encountered Descartes as an undergraduate at university, and I had some amazing teachers, including a woman called Pat Wise, and I'm pretty sure it was in one of her classes that I first was forced to read Descartes and got deeply angry, along with all of my feminist friends. And you know how being an undergraduate is. I'm angry in a less overt way now. and I was fascinated by his work and by a lot of the work that follows on after it and critiques it and is consistently engaged with it. So I think he's an interesting, not even a starting point, but a kind of locus of energy in terms of those debates around the relationship or between the body and the mind, or the separation between the body and the mind. I've given birth to four children. I have four children. And I think perhaps that more than anything else is the experience that for me made me really resist Descartes, that Cartesian split. And not just the giving birth, actually, which sounds like that's the thing, but just the experience of mothering people. And it's very hard to explain. I guess the thing is that I couldn't, and I still can't, marry the idea of there being this absolute split, and that consciousness can exist without a body, with my personal experiences and with the experiences of lots of other women that I know and have spoken to, and several men as well, although I don't have this conversations as productively with me often.
Sure.
But I just don't think it's possible. And more I as I've grown up and moved, you know, my children are all grown up now. It's less about that, but that was the thing that gave me access to it at first. You know, you don't love with your body. I love my lover with my body too.
Yeah.
It's not just an intellectual thinking exercise. It's a deeply embodied experience of the world that we have.
Sure.
So,
and this connects to one of the other things that I think is almost a call to arms, really, in your speech, in where you talk about your hope that feminists would speak about mothering in new and more interesting ways, which I imagine was possibly a little, I don't know whether it would have been provocative, but certainly a call to arms. Did that lead to any conversations at WizCon around that issue, or...? That you eavesdropped on?
No, not that I'm aware of. Not that I'm aware of, but it's something I'm very passionate about. I don't think feminism has largely been very good at talking about mothering. We've been very good at talking about reproductive rights.
Yep.
We've sometimes been good at talking about legal rights around our rights to our children or, you know, those sorts of things, rights in the context of the family court, for example, or those sorts of things. I don't think that we've been particularly good at talking about the practice of mothering and its kind of lived realities. And I don't think we've been very good at that. I don't think we've paid much attention to it, partly, that it's an uncomfortable space.
So do you think stories that, I guess, include different ways of mothering and different ways of being a mother, is that the sort of thing that you'd like to see from speculative fiction? Or
yeah, I think absolutely, and not just speculative fiction, like fiction across the board. I'm also interested in one of my kind of persistent bugbears about writing about mothers is that in fiction particularly, often women have babies. If they have done it all, they have babies and then they're off stage until some convenient later point in the narrative where they appear. And I don't know if you or any of your listeners have, I'm sure some of your listeners have children, but, you know, my experience of mothering was that it was never off stage.
Sure. And then there's that awesome trope of the magical pregnancy where it happens really quickly and then it's over with and you don't have to worry about it anymore in the story.
Yeah, it's all whisked off, or it's occasional, it's quite Victorian almost. The nanny comes in and you kiss them on the forehead and off they go to bed so that you can conveniently carry on protagging your life.
Yes.
And I just, you know, that's one of my bugbears, so that this idea that children, you know, they're kind of just narrative devices in novels. They're often not. That relationship isn't interrogated. Except, you know, when it's an adult woman and her adult, very adult mother. And we're more interested in those stories, I think. But certainly also just different ways of mothering and kind of more nuanced depictions of mothering in different types of families and with different types of women. And
Well, as I said, I'll put a link to your speech in our show notes. I think everyone should go and read it and be challenged and inspired by it. Have you had any Australian recognition of your winning of the Tiptree Award? People seem to know about it.
The people I talk to know about it.
Good, I'm glad.
I have. I'm not a very social person. So I am on social media, but I'm not a very social person, so I don't know. There was a review of the book in The Australian some time ago, before it won.
Yep.
And it did also, it was shortlisted for an Aurealis Award before the Tiptree, and it recently won the Norma K. Heming Award.
Oh, yes, I was going to mention that. Congratulations on that, too.
Thank you. At Continuum. So, and certainly around those things, people have then contacted me and said, oh, we heard about the Tiptree. So, yeah, I think it's certainly more visible than the book was before. I think the Tiptree's had an incredible impact on the visibility of the book, which, of course, I'm very pleased about.
Yep. Yeah, fantastic. All of which leads me, and you alluded to this earlier, to ask, what's in the pipeline? What are you working on at the moment?
Oh.
If it's too awkward to discuss, that's fine.
No, so I have one book that's with my agent being shopped, which is called Dying in the First Person, and it's very hard to say what it's about. It's partly about twin boys who have a completely, who when they're young, they're over-educated boys, and when they're young, they create a language, but in order to create a language, they have to create a culture that goes alongside it. And the culture that they create is a culture that lives on an archipelago. And on this archipelago, they're very young boys. archipelago is a series of islands, and the islands are also small and delicate, but they can only ever support one man.
Mm.
So it's an archipelago, which every man is indeed an island. And there are no women. So the language has not no gender, but only one gender.
Mm-hmm.
And six cases. So I'm quite interested in language.
Excellent.
So the book is about that and about the relationship between those things.
Yep.
And then I'm working on a book at the moment, which is much harder to talk about, called The Book of Ruth. It's again about gender, really, but about family,
mm-hmm.
And ghosts. The main characters and her parent come out to Australia after the Second World War and are followed by the ghosts of their mother, their dead mother.
That sounds intriguing.
I think so. That's why I'm still working.
Good. Beyond that, do you have grand ambitions for what you want to achieve with your writing, or do you think usually more short to medium term?
Before I would die, I'd like to write a book that, at least one. I have a lot of things that I want to write about, so I guess I have more, you know, there are things that I want to explore. So I'm ambitious in that sense. I don't know that I'm ambitious in the worldly sense.
Sure.
I'm lucky enough to have a job that's pretty safe, and that means that that I focus on the writing itself. I went for a long time. The Repetta got rejected like 20 times or something, I can't remember now. And it was a very humbling experience. But it taught me not to I learned that I wanted to write anyway, and that I would write the book that mattered to me, and then either I would sell it or I wouldn't, and either it would find its readership or it wouldn't, but that I would write the books anyway. And really that's where I am. I will write the books anyway that matter to me, and hopefully they will find publishers and they will find readers and become part of a conversation about changing the world.
That sounds like a series of grand ambitions to me.
They are a bit grand. Oh, dear.
No, that's great. And I think that's a grand point on which to finish the interview. Looking forward to you contributing to the conversation and changing the world, basically.
Oh, thank you. You too.
So thank you very much for joining me, Nikki.
Thank you, Alexandra. It's been a pleasure.